Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
How did study sanctify St. Thomas Aquinas? This is a significant question because it's easy for many people to consider St. Thomas as sort of like a medieval large language model system implanted in a big but irrelevant Italian body, okay? But very rarely do scholars and your typical Catholics consider St. Thomas as a man, as a personality, and as his most important attribute, as a saint. The question about how study sanctified Aquinas is revelatory, because the word study itself admits of different senses, and each sense manifests something distinctive about St. Thomas Aquinas himself. Study, for St. Thomas, is a vast concept, much broader than what we think of doing things like, you know, study and homework or like prepping for exams or doing research, okay? That's a particular narrower sense of the word study. Just looking at the Latin origin, the word studium, or the verb studere, has a much wider range of meaning than it does in English, okay? So beyond what we would think of as study in the formal academic intellectual sense, studium means what? Studium invokes an attitude of zeal and of eagerness, of effort and of application, exertion towards some definite end, specifically an end that is desirable, something that brings a sense of delight, a sense of accomplishment and its attainment. Studium expresses both the goal and the endeavor undertaken towards the goal. If you wanted to get really good at baking, for example, your study would not only be the delight of finally making a flaky, buttery croissant, okay? But it would be all of the times that you practiced baking a croissant. It would be your consulting of different recipes, of trying out different techniques and ingredients, of having your friend be your guinea pig. Hey, bro, taste this, okay? It would be just even thinking about croissants, okay? Study is being eager for something in its final stage and on every step along the way there. It's in this sense of study that I would like to focus on in St. Thomas, okay? Aquinas was sanctified, he was made holy, he grew in grace and charity precisely through the eagerness that was the engine of his life. To illustrate this, I will draw upon the Secunda Secundae of the Summa. Now, who knows Secunda Secundae? What's going on in that part of the Summa? No one, anyone know? What's going on there? Morals, yeah, morals in detail, okay? So the second part in general is like, you know, our progression towards God. And first part of the second part is like the general principles, second part of the second part, the specific, okay? So out of all the works of St. Thomas, the place where he talks about study the most is in the second part of the second part of the Summa. So I'm going to focus there, okay? And I'm going to, now, Aquinas didn't write a lot about himself, okay? He didn't like talk about, how am I feeling today? Let me tell you, okay? So I'm going to use what he says about study in the second part of the second part as a window into St. Thomas himself, okay? So, and we're going to look through three windows, three places in the Secunda Secundae where Aquinas treats study. Sound good? Okay. The first and perhaps the most important place where study makes its appearance is when Aquinas discusses the theological virtue of charity. Specifically, where? Question 24, Article 9. Question 24, Article 9. Now, before diving right in, it's good to realize that charity for Aquinas is kind of like the hokey pokey. It's what it's all about. Okay? If the point of life is to be united with God in happiness, then charity is essential because it is precisely that by which we are united to God in loving friendship, founded upon God's own communication, his own gift of himself to us in grace. So Aquinas writes elsewhere, quote, "The spiritual life consists principally in charity. For he who is without charity is reputed to be spiritually nothing." Nihil. Okay? The spiritual life is not about creating meaning in our life. It's not about practices that cultivate unique esoteric experiences. It's not about achieving balance or serenity. What's it about? It's about loving the Lord our God with all our mind, heart, soul, and strength, and our neighbor as ourself. To have charity is the greatest success. To lack it is the greatest failure, no matter what else we do or what good we produce. Nor is charity identical with love. All charity is love, but not all love is charity. Charity is a very specific kind of love. It is intellectual, insofar as it is not something we feel with our body. Rather, it takes place in our will, the desiring function of our mind in its aspect of knowing the good. It is also supernatural, insofar as it is something that can only come about because of God's infusion of sanctifying grace, of allowing us a participation in his own life and beatitude that transcends all of our limited natural capabilities. Charity is a divine love in the will, whereby we are granted perception of the goodness of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, not as distant, but as immanent and dwelling within the very operations of our soul. In that love, there is a salvific, beatifying friendship. What does Christ say? "I no longer call you servants, but my friends." Okay? That friendship is charity. So in question 24, St. Thomas is looking at charity not as kind of a disembodied idea, but specifically as something instantiated in us, as something perfective of our intellectual appetite, that is, of our will. Article 9, in particular, question 24, Article 9, is the climax of how Aquinas explains charity can grow, can increase within us. And it's right there that study appears. Okay, good. Yeah, so let's get into this. So Aquinas delineates in this article three grades, three stages of charity, three degrees of the spiritual life. What differentiates one grade from another is what, in charity, you study. And by this, okay, he doesn't mean something like beginners in the spiritual life study English lit. Okay? More advanced people move on to physics, and the highest, most spiritually illuminated people do economics. Okay? Okay? No. So remember that study has the sense of what? Of pursuit, of effort, of seeking. Okay? What you are seeking in the spiritual life is indicative of how thoroughly charity has transformed you into a friend of God. And there's an inner logic to how charity grows. And it determines a precise order by which one progresses through different studies. Okay? So St. Thomas writes, question 24, Article 9, quote, "The diverse grades of charity are distinguished according to the diversa studia, to which a man is led by growth in charity. And what are these stages? Great question. He says this: for the first study, which is incumbent on a man, is principally to draw back from sin and to resist his concupiscence, which moves him contrary to charity. And this pertains to beginners, in whom charity must be nourished and fostered, lest it be corrupted. The second study follows, where a man principally intends that by which he grows in goodness. And this study pertains to the proficient, who principally intend to make charity stronger in themselves by its growth. The third study is when a man principally intends to cling to God and to enjoy Him. And this pertains to the perfect, who wish to be dissolved and to be with Christ, Philippians 1, end quote. So, we can say that Aquinas, as a saint, as one who reached the perfection of the Christian life, devoted himself to the highest study, the study of clinging to God in love, the study of enjoying God. Everything else was secondary, ancillary, or supportive of this one great task. That is first and foremost how study sanctified Aquinas. Okay? That's the first one. All right. Ready for the second? Good. Okay. The second place in the Secunda Secundae where we can look at study, the second window into Aquinas as a saint, is way further along in question 166, which is on the virtue of studiositas, studiousness. Okay? Studiousness. Okay? So, this is perhaps a little bit more what you expect when you hear the word study. However, Aquinas is going to throw a curveball. The virtue of studiousness is not really about how smart you are. St. Thomas was not a saint because of his IQ alone. Okay? There can be someone who does really well in school, but might not have the virtue of studiousness. There can also be someone who completely whiffs it in their formal education, and yet can be a titan of study. Why is this? Well, because there are some virtues that pertain to how well you use your mind to perform different sorts of actions pertaining to knowledge of the truth. And these are called the intellectual virtues. You can read about these in the Prima Secundae, question 57, okay? Now, some intellectual virtues are speculative. They perfect the mind in knowing things, okay? The virtue of understanding, the virtue of science, the virtue of wisdom, okay? Some are practical, like prudence, okay? Now, as important as these virtues are, however, Aquinas is very clear that one can possess these speculative intellectual virtues, okay, understanding, science, and wisdom, and at the same time, be a bad person. Okay, one can have these speculative virtues and be a bad person. Okay, now we know from, for example, history, from literature and film, as well as our own personal experiences, that smart people can be jerks. Okay. I think we'll hear more about this later, but they can be jerks, okay? They can be proud. They can be devious. They can rationalize their bad behavior. They can manipulate others. They can use their mental prowess for evil. Think of the wonderful phrases that we have. Evil genius. Criminal mastermind. Mad scientist. Okay, those all describe this phenomenon. Okay? The demons are hyper-intelligent. They're just basically a big, piercing intellect. And yet, they're evil. Why can there be this disconnect between intelligence and goodness? Because there's another set of virtues that serve as the benchmark, not for a person's intelligence, but for their goodness. And these simply go by the name of moral virtues, okay? The moral virtues not only involve what we do with our knowledge, but they are what direct all of our actions so as to be good and conducive towards our progress towards beatitude. They do this by one way or another providing a habit, a durable enhancement to those key motors of the moral life, which are called the appetites, okay? We are the sort of thing that is not perfect from the get-go. We have to seek out our perfection. We have to seek out the things that lead us to perfection. This seeking capability is our appetitive power. The moral virtues perfect this power in its different dimensions, making it so that what we seek is in accord with right reason, and how we seek it is fitting and wisely ordered. Now, the virtue of temperance is one such virtue, okay? It is the perfection of our ability to desire. The person who is temperate is not a, you know, white-knuckled stress ball, okay, who is always like afraid of a good time, okay? They freely, easily, and pleasantly desire true goods of the body and the soul. They're equally powerful and adroit at repelling desires that are shameful, disordered, and not suited for their physical and spiritual health. The temperate person knows how to moderate their desires so that those desires resonate with and actualize their deepest desire, which is desire for happiness with God. That's a pretty powerful virtue, okay? And depending on the good that is desired, there are different species of temperance. The right desire for physical goods, such as food, drink, and sex, all have different names. Abstinence, sobriety, chastity. The right desire for spiritual goods, such as excellence and mirth, also have different names. Humility, eutropalia. But what about studiousness? Studiousness is a form of temperance. It moderates our desire for the spiritual good of knowledge. Now notice, it's not knowledge itself, but our desire for knowledge. It's not doing homework or research, but why and how you're doing homework and research. While knowledge is good considered by itself, Aquinas recognizes that our desire for it might not be. He points out that sin can creep into our search for knowledge in several major ways, all falling under the vice of curiosity, which you can learn about this afternoon in one of the breakout sessions, okay? Just as lust is the vitiation of our desire for sexual pleasure, so is curiosity the vitiation for our desire for knowledge. What is studiousness then? Study, writes Aquinas, and I think Sister Anna will draw on this a bit more, is the vehement application of the mind to something. The vehement application of the mind to something. When this study, this application of the mind is animated by a desire for a truly good end, when it's commensurate with your responsibilities and your state in life, when you draw from the right teachers and sources, when it's complementary to your desire for happiness with God, when you progress in a wise sequence, neither jumping too far ahead nor shimmying off course, then you can be said to be studious. Knowledge is not an enemy to the moral life. When we pursue it, when we study it well, it contributes to our perfection and provides us on earth a foretaste of our ultimate happiness, which consists in knowing God. So, study sanctified Aquinas in this sense. His pursuit of knowledge was not divorced from his pursuit of God, but thoroughly entrenched within it. His knowledge was for the ultimate end, and his pursuit of it was wisely ordered thereto, in a way that vivified and animated his own friendship with God. Okay, the third and final place where we can look at study in the Secunda Secundae, the third window into St. Thomas, is in question 179, which is kind of towards the end of the Summa. Okay, questions 1 through 170 are all about particular things that pertain to every single Christian, no matter what. Okay, every Christian should have the virtue, should be involved in the studies of charity. Every Christian should have the virtue of studiositas. Questions 171 through 189, however, examine particular things that apply to some Christians, or that help distinguish some Christians from another. One such division is, for example, according to the gratuitous or the charismatic graces that God grants to some people. Okay? Another division is according to the various offices and states of life to which some people are called, marriage, being a teacher or a pastor, so on and so forth. But there's another division. The tradition has long looked at the account of the sisters Martha and Mary, presented in the Gospel of Luke, as being prototypes for every Christian disciple. They provide a template not just for our little tasks here and there, but for the overarching structure of our life. Martha was busy serving the Lord, and Mary sat listening at his feet. Every one of us, too, is either a Martha or a Mary in our relation to Christ. Our life has a definite shape to it that one of these two women exemplify. Mary represents the contemplative life, and Martha represents the active life. And everyone is either one or the other. But what is it that distinguishes a contemplative from an active? There are contemplatives who are very busy. Okay? And there are actives who contemplate. In fact, every Christian should contemplate. What makes the difference for Aquinas is study. Again, this is not study in the sense of like what kind of homework do you do, but study in the sense of what is it that you apply yourself to? What is your exertion drive at? What is it that you are seeking to do in this life? Specifically, the distinction between the active and the contemplative life is about what sort of action stands as the goal of your life's study. St. Thomas says this, quote, "Another difference between people is according to diverse lives, namely the active and the contemplative, which are understood according to the diverse studies of operation." For Aquinas here, it's black and white. There's no mix or gray. You are either an active or a contemplative, which means that you are oriented either towards doing things or oriented towards knowing things. That orientation is the study of your life. What the active does, including contemplation, is geared towards action. What the contemplative does, including work, is geared towards knowledge. It's not a simple question of time or a certain ratio between how much you think versus how much you socialize. The true test for discerning what the study of your life is ultimately recognizing what good gives you the most delight. What good founds the basis of your friendships? So Aquinas writes, 179, Article 1, "The life of every man seems to be that in which he maximally delights, and towards which he maximally intends, and in which he chiefly wishes to associate with a friend. If helping others through public policy galvanizes you, okay? If you go to school because you want to go make a difference in society through just laws founded upon noble and true principles, if your friends nerd out about referendums and the latest buzz from Capitol Hill, you, my friend, are one doozy of an active, okay? If, however, you chase the thrill of solving a rarefied physics problem, if you have crafted your diet, sleep, exercise, and social life to make it so that you can bring your A game to research, if your friends can't stop talking about the inaccuracies of the quantum realm in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, then, my friend, you are a contemplative. You live to know. In either case, your life is measured by your study. And in following that study, you find your delight, you find your purpose, and you find your friends. What was Aquinas? He was an active. Okay? That might sound a little surprising, but I'll make a case for this. He was an active. As contemplative as he was a Dominican. And how does St. Thomas himself describe Dominicans? As a type of active religious. We can make a lot of, there are maybe like 50 asterisks we can add to this, but we won't get into that right now, okay? As a type of active religious. A type of active whose work requires contemplation as a basis, okay? And that is the activities of preaching and teaching. St. Thomas was a teacher. He was a preacher. Who were his friends? Okay? Fellow friars whose entire study was to save souls. The Primitive Constitutions of the Order says this: our study, studia nostra, ought to tend principally, ardently, and with the highest endeavor to the end that we might be useful to the souls of our neighbors. That's Dominican study. That was Aquinas' study. It was in teaching his own brothers. It was in serving the Holy Church of God. It was in handing on to others the fruits of his contemplation, the light of Sacra Doctrina, that he was sanctified. So, in all, how did study sanctify Aquinas? First, because it was a study of charity. Second, because it was a temperate study, wisely ordered towards this ultimate end. And third, because it gave shape to his entire life, to love, to seek, and to serve. Those were the studies of a saint. There you go.
Give me this.
I am not Father Thomas Aquinas. I was listed first, but we thought it would be better that, in Father's words, he does the alley-oop and I do the slam dunk. Was that it? Yeah. Studying and being sanctified both have something to do with how we direct our attention. One thing that is manifestly true about attention, that was true in Thomas's time and that's still true for whatever generation you are, it's impossible for us to give our full attention to more than one thing at a time. Since each of you had the ability to attend two other breakout sessions, I'd like to begin by thanking you for attending this one. One of the things that I ask my students to do at the beginning of each semester is to identify one of their superpowers. A select number of students misunderstand the prompt and declare that they would like to fly. Another group of students understand the prompt, but don't think about themselves very well, and declare that time management, or even worse, multitasking, is their superpower. I fall into the group of people that thinks too much about superpowers and too much about myself. In evidence of this, and in order to give you time to adjust to the unique expression of Thomism that you've committed yourself to when you chose to attend this session, I'll identify three of my superpowers. My first superpower is that I can take a simple, straightforward topic given to me by the Thomistic Institute and spend more time generating a grammatically complex and clever title than I spend penning the talk itself. It was a moral victory for me to stick with the TI given, "How does studying sanctify me?" rather than "The spiritual pearls and perils of studying, colon, the crucifixion of the desk, question mark." My second superpower is that I can divide any talk into three parts, each with three subdivisions. In my case, this isn't cleverness, but pathology. I promise you that it always just happens to be the case that, for me, things fall together in threes. Someone somewhere said that we can only really count to three. This someone might have been Edmund Husserl, but it also might have been me. And this leads to my third superpower. I can recognize patterns and principles just as well as I can forget, almost entirely, the particulars from whence the patterns came. You've been warned. In the Q&A, direct all those questions to Father. All of this talk of threes is only a long way of saying that this talk will be divided into three parts, each with three subparts of their own. In order to answer, how does studying sanctify me, and by me, I mean you, I'll begin by looking at the activity of studying, at two things that it primarily isn't, and one thing that it primarily is. Part two will look at the activity of being sanctified, at two things that it primarily isn't, and one thing that it primarily is. And the final part will look at studying so as to be sanctified, at two things it primarily isn't, and one thing it primarily is. Some of you will get motion sick as we go repeatedly from hearing what something isn't to what it is without any gentle transitions. But this messy stop and start way of proceeding is, in my experience, a faithful description both of the activity of studying and of the activity of being sanctified. Without further ado, part one. What are we doing when we study? First, studying is not contemplation. To be precise, studying isn't the activity of contemplating, of resting our attention on one thing, and of allowing our desire to rest on what we behold. We might say that a father studies the face of his newborn child, but unless he's a very odd father, he's not directing his attention to his son in the same way that he directs it to a World Cup bracket or at Thomas's account of free will. Studying requires the activities of noticing, of focusing on some things, of deliberately not focusing on others, of puzzling, memorizing, and occasionally of attending to our attending. In short, the only thing that studying doesn't involve is the activity of contemplating. The reason why we might be excused for mistaking these two activities is that contemplation is the rest that we enjoy after we've done the work of studying. For those of you who speak jargon, contemplation is the telos at which study aims as a means. Second, studying is not reading the brilliant things that St. Thomas wrote. At least, it's not that, simply and primarily. I know I don't need to make an argument here at Veritas in favor of your reading St. Thomas. What I do think needs to be pointed out here at Veritas is the danger of mistaking reading exquisitely clear and technical texts about, say, charity for the study of charity. Reading Thomas is a helpful part of studying, but if all we do is read and repeat, we've directed our attention to a less than ultimate target. The point of studying isn't simply to have great words about the order of reality, but to be aware of the order of reality and of the greatness of Thomas's words. To put it differently, the danger we face if we reduce studying to an uncritical reading of Thomas is that we commit balderdash. We get used to using Thomas's words in the way that he used them, and this familiarity gives us the sense that we both understand those words and believe what they mean. Just so that you know that I'm including myself here in the pronoun we, when I took my first class in metaphysics, I was so enthralled that I tried to teach my parrot quidquid recipitur ad modens recipientis recipitur. All the bird managed to get out was quidquid, which in Latin roughly means whatever. Third, studying is the vehement application of the mind to something. For those of you who, unlike my parrot, appreciate Latin, Thomas's phrase is vehemens applicatio mentis ad aliquid. Here, we have stumbled across a subdivision into three. First, to say that studying is an application of the mind is to say that studying isn't a spontaneous event. It's a choice, a moral choice, both to begin to study and to persevere. Second, in studying, our mental application is vehement. It needs to be vehement because what we're applying our mind to, if we're really studying, are areas where confusion and darkness reign. If all we're attending to when we're reading are radiantly clear truths that we already believe, we're doing something far more passive than studying. Note that for Thomas, studying is not a matter of receiving information. It's a robust exercise of your attentional agency. Our mental application not only needs to be vehement, it's also fitting that it be vehement, since the ultimate goal of studying is that we conform our lives to the real. It's one thing to understand a principle well enough to teach it to your parrot, or to parrot it at a conference or on a test. And it's another thing to understand it well enough to see it showing up or not showing up in how you live. The evidence that you studied well is that you let what you have seen take root in your life. Third, in studying, we vehemently apply our mind to something. And the Latin here is aliquid, not quidquid. Although it's theoretically possible for us to study just about any something, certain somethings are more fitting targets for our vehement attending than others. Since the ultimate goal of studying is that we conform our lives to the real, and since reality isn't just bits of information, but is an ordered display of somethings, studying will be more fruitful for us the more we direct our attention to the higher somethings that order the lower somethings. So, it's possible to study trends in video game coding, but it's preferable to study astrophysics, or if you're really vehement, philosophy, or economics. We didn't plan this, by the way. A final comment. For Thomas, self-scrutiny doesn't count as studying. This is to say, the something to which we apply our mind must not be merely our own mind. We can only apply ourselves vehemently to something that bumps up against us, to something other. Part two, how do we go about being sanctified? In one of the breakout sessions that you chose not to attend, two speakers, a theologian and a philosopher, are having a wrestling match to try to determine which discipline is the better one. Kind of. He's leaving for it. My contribution to that wrestling match is this. Although theologians get bragging rights about studying the queen of the sciences, philosophers get to be goofy as they study. That is, until they come across something that merits reverence. Since certain aspects of the topic of sanctity fall in the revere and don't goof category, I want to be specific about what I'm targeting here so that I'm less likely to be mistaken for a theologian. I mean, less likely to fall into irreverence. I'd like to fix our attention on three human contributions to the activity of being sanctified. This is to say, I'll focus on whatever it is that we do to try to facilitate, or at least not get in the way, of our being made holy. I'm taking sanctification here in the biblical, non-technical sense as being made like God and as being set apart for God. I'll comment on three things we do to contribute to our being like God and for God. Since it's easier to goof about being like and for St. Thomas, I'll use that as an analogy. First, we become like Thomas not primarily by imitation. I can achieve some likeness to St. Thomas if I give myself a tonsure, wear a big rosary, and recite Latin phrases. But to the extent that I'm the one choosing what to imitate, my likeness will be superficial at best. Second, we can become like Thomas by dedication, but not primarily by dedication. I can be for St. Thomas in some way if I dedicate eating my breakfast or writing my term paper to him. But to the extent that these acts of dedication fall on my initiative, I make myself Thomas's benefactor rather than allowing him to benefact me. Also, it's possible for us to get so caught up in the activity of dedicating things to Thomas that we neglect the most important activity, which is to be with him. So, third, we become like Thomas primarily by communion. Simply put, the way to become like Thomas, or like God, is to be with him. Since we can't be with Thomas without doing something with him, this means that we need to let him affect us while we recite his Latin, write a term paper, or endure a tedious talk divided into threes. All our acts of imitation and dedication are fruitless if they don't lead to our being with the one we love, the one who loved us first. Stepping out of the analogy, our primary contribution to our being sanctified is letting God be with us in everything that we do. Part three, how should we study so as to be sanctified? Since "so as to" is a really funny phrase, let me give two alternate versions of the question. What is it about studying that sanctifies us? What aspect of studying should we target if we wish to maximize our being with God? Here are three options. First, it's not primarily by the discipline that study requires that we're sanctified. Discipline is necessary for becoming holy, but holiness is much, much more than being disciplined. To put it crudely, you won't become capable of beholding the face of God if, during World Cup season, you can't fix your attention on things objectively greater than soccer. And yet, to be self-disciplined enough to fix your attention on things greater than soccer is neither identical with being like God nor with beholding his face. Second, it's not primarily by the delight that studying brings that we're sanctified. In heaven, when we're no longer being sanctified, we'll be doing nothing but delighting in God. While we're on our way to heaven, it can be good to study in order to be trained in the habit of attending to great things and delighting in them. To target this training in delight as our primary means of sanctification, though, is dangerous. If we study primarily in order to experience wonder and delight, we'll end up using study as a distraction from difficulties and from confusion. But these experiences of difficulty and confusion are precisely what real study brings us to encounter. It seems to me that most of us try to resolve the dangers of studying for discipline and studying for delight by holding the two in balance. We study for discipline until doing so threatens our ability to enjoy life. And we study for delight until doing so threatens our ability to remain disciplined. This isn't entirely bad, and I'm confident that we fall into this with very good intentions. But it's also not entirely good to be aiming at balance and to do so only by negative means. It's as though we're trying to maintain a steady speed on the highway with one foot firmly on the gas and the other firmly on the brake. So, the third and best way to be sanctified in study is to allow God to be with us in all of our acts and in all of our responses. In short, we become sanctified through our study when we surrender ourselves to his action. What I mean by surrender is the explicit and ongoing invitation to God to do in and through us whatever he desires. Here's what surrender might look like when you sit down at your desk. Invite the Holy Spirit to direct your attention wherever he desires. Trust that he receives your invitation, even if you don't immediately notice anything, or if you notice things that overwhelm you. Open your imagination to the Holy Spirit. Invite him to be present in your imagination, even in the parts that you can't see. Invite him to draw out of your memory anything that he desires. And then, don't make a rule for yourself for how you'll respond to what you see. Even what the Holy Spirit has inclined you to in the past shouldn't be made into a rule. Make your only rule to say, "Into your hands I commend my spirit." If we practice this surrender perseveringly and vehemently, we will become his delighted disciples, delighted by the presence of God and becoming like him by being with him. I'd like to close with one final trio. In the convent, it's not uncommon to hear the refrain, "Do the best you can with the time you have for the love of God." I don't think you can go wrong with this, as long as you keep in mind that the "for" here doesn't primarily mean that we're giving God the gift of our efforts, but that we're doing all that we do as a way of being for him and as a way of being open to who he is for us. Do everything for the sake of being with him.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.